9. The picnic basket had been scarlet when it was new, and had faded only a little over its long life, perhaps because so much of it had been spent tucked away in the attic. I began by hefting one of the handles. The damn thing was pretty heavy, all right. I guessed about 20 pounds. The wicker on the bottom, although tightly woven, had sagged down some. I set it back on the carpet, pushed the thin wooden carry handles down to either side, and flipped back the lid on hinges that squeaked slightly. There were colored pencils, most of which had been sharpened down to stubs. There were drawings made by a certain child prodigy well over 80 years ago. A little girl who'd fallen out of a pony trap at the age of 2 and banged her head and awakened with seizures and a magical ability to draw. I knew this, even though the drawing on the first page wasn't a drawing at all, not really, just an uncertain line running across the middle of the paper. I flicked it up. Beneath was a stick figure of a tree, nothing more. After that, the pictures became pictures, growing in technique and sophistication with a speed that was beyond belief, unless that was you happened to be a guy like Edgar Fremantle, who had done little more than doodle until an accident on a building site had taken his arm, crushed his skull, and nearly ended his life. She had drawn fields, palms, the beach, a gigantic black face round as a basketball, with a smiling red mouth, probably Melda the housekeeper, although this Melda looked like an overgrown child in extreme close-up. Then more animals, raccoons, a turtle, a deer, a bobcat, that were naturally sized, but walking on the gulf or flying through the air. I found a heron, executed in perfect detail, standing on the balcony railing of the house she'd grown up in. Directly below it was another watercolor of the same bird, only this time it was hovering upside down over the swimming pool. The gimlet eyes staring out of the picture were the same shade as the pool itself. She was doing what I've been doing, I thought, and my skin began to creep again, trying to reinvent the ordinary, make it new by turning it into a dream. Would Dario, Jimmy, and Alice cream their jeans if they saw these? I thought there was no doubt. Here were two little girls, Tessie and Laura, surely, with great big pumpkin smiles that deliberately overran the edges of their faces. Here was a daddy bigger than the house beside which he stood, had to be the first heron's roost, smoking a cigar the size of a rocket. A smoke ring circled the moon overhead. Here were two girls in dark green jumpers on a dirt road with school books balanced on their heads the way some African native girls balance their pots. Maria and Hannah, no doubt. Behind them came a line of frogs. In defiance of perspective, the frogs grew larger rather than smaller. Next came Elizabeth's smiling horses phase. There were a dozen or more. I leafed through them, then turned back to one and tapped it. This is the one that was in the newspaper article. Wireman said, "Go a little deeper. You ain't seen nothing yet." More horses. More family rendered in pencil or charcoal or in jolly watercolors. The family members almost always with their hands linked like paper dolls. Then a storm. The water in the swimming pool lashed into waves, the fronds of a palm pulled into ragged banners by the wind. There were well over 100 pictures in all. She might only have been a child, but she had also been unbottling. 2 or 3 more storm pictures, maybe the Alice that had uncovered Eastlake's treasure trove, maybe just a big thunderstorm. It was impossible to say for sure. Then the gulf again, this time with flying fish the size of dolphins. The gulf with pelicans that appeared to have rainbows in their mouths. The gulf at sunset, and I stopped, my breath caught in my throat. Compared with many of the others I'd gone through, this one was dead simple. Just the silhouette of a ship against the dying light, caught at the tipping point between day and dark, but its simplicity was what gave it its power. Certainly I'd thought so when I drew the same thing on my first night in Big Pink. Here was the same cable, stretched taut between the bow and what might in Elizabeth's time have been called the Marconi Tower, creating a brilliant orange triangle. Here was the same upward shading of light, orange to blue. There was even the same scribbly, not quite careless overlay of color that made the ship, skinnier than mine had been, look like a phantom out there, trudging its way north. "I drew this," I said faintly. "I know," Wireman said. "I've seen it. You called it hello." I thumbed deeper, hurrying through big bunches of watercolors and colored pencil drawings, knowing what I would eventually find. And yes, near the bottom, I came to Elizabeth's first picture of the Percy. Only she had drawn it new, a slim three-masted beauty with sails furled, standing in on the blue-green waters of the Gulf beneath a trademark Elizabeth Eastlake sun, the kind that shoots off long, happy rays of light. It was a wonderful piece of work, almost begging for a Calypso soundtrack. But unlike her other paintings, it also felt false. "Keep going, muchacho." The ship, family, four of them anyway, standing on the beach with their hands linked like paper dolls and those big Elizabeth happy smiles. The ship, the house with what looked like a Negro lawn jockey standing on its head. The ship, that gorgeous white swallow, John Eastlake screaming, blood running from his nose and one eye. I stared at it mesmerized. It was a child's watercolor, but it had been executed with hellish skill. It depicted a man who looked insane with terror, grief, or both. "My God," I said. "One more, muchacho," Wireman said. "One more to go." I flicked back the picture of the screaming man. Old dried watercolors rattled like bones. Beneath the screaming father was the ship again, only this time it really was my ship, my Percy. Elizabeth had painted it at night, and not with a brush. I could still see the ancient dried prints of her child's fingers in the swirls of gray and black. This time it was as if she had finally seen through the Percy's disguise. The boards were splintered, the sails drooping and full of holes. Around her, blue in the light of a moon that did not smile or send out happy rays, hundreds of skeleton arms rose from the water in a dripping salute. And standing on the foredeck was a baggy, pallid thing, vaguely female, wearing a decayed something that might have been a cloak, a winding shroud, or a robe. It was the red robe, my red robe, only seen from the front. Three empty sockets peered from its head, and its grin outran the sides of its face in a crazy jumble of lips and teeth. It was far more horrible than my girl in ship paintings, because it went straight to the heart of the matter without any pause for the mind to catch up. "This is everything awful," it said. "This is everything you ever feared to find waiting in the dark. See how its grin raises off its face in the moonlight. See how the drowned salute it." "Christ," I said, looking up at Wireman. "When do you think? After her sisters?" "Must have been. Must have been her way of coping with it, don't you think?" "I don't know," I said. Part of me was trying to think of my own girls, and part of me was trying not to. I don't know how a kid, any kid, could come up with something like that. "Race memory," Wireman said. "That's what the Jungians would say. And how did I end up painting the same fucking ship? Maybe the same fucking creature, only from the back. Did the Jungians have any theories about that?" "It doesn't say Percy on Elizabeth's," Jack pointed out. "She would have been four," I said. I doubt if the name would have made much of an impression on her. I thought of her earlier pictures, the ones where this boat had been a beautiful white lie she had believed for a little while. Especially once she saw what it really was. "You talk as if it were real," Wireman said. My mouth was very dry. I went to the bathroom, drew myself a glass of water, and drank it down. "I don't know what I believe about this," I said. "But I have a general rule of thumb in life, Wireman. If one person sees a thing, it could be a hallucination. If two people see it, chances of reality improve exponentially. Elizabeth and I both saw the Percy." "In your imaginations," Wireman said. In your imaginations you saw it. I pointed to Wireman's face and said, You've seen what my imagination can do. He didn't reply, but he nodded. He was very pale. You said once she saw what it really was, Jack said. If the boat in the picture is real, what is it exactly? I think you know, Wireman said. I think we all do. It's pretty damned hard to miss. We're just afraid to say it out loud. Go on, Jack. God hates a coward. Okay, it's a ship of the dead, Jack said. His voice was flat in my clean, well-lighted studio. He put his hands to his head and raked his fingers slowly through his hair, making it wilder than ever. But I'll tell you something, you guys. If that's what's coming for me in the end, I sort of wish I'd never been born in the first place. 10. I set the thick stack of drawings and watercolors aside on the carpet, delighted to get the last two out of my sight. Then I looked at what had been under her pictures, weighing the picnic basket down. It was ammo for the spear pistol. I lifted one of the stubby harpoons out. It was about 15 inches long and quite heavy. The shaft was steel, not aluminum. I wasn't sure aluminum had been even used in the 1920s. The business end was triple-bladed, and although the blades were tarnished, they looked sharp. I touched the ball of my finger to one, and a tiny bead of blood appeared on the skin instantly. You ought to disinfect that, Jack said. Yes, indeed, I said. I turned the thing over in the afternoon sun, sending reflections bounding around the walls. The short harpoon had its own ugly beauty, a paradox perhaps reserved exclusively for certain weapons of efficiency. This wouldn't go very far in water, I said. Not as heavy as it is. You'd be surprised, Wireman said. The gun fires off a spring and a CO2 cartridge. She bangs pretty good. And back in those days, short range was enough. The Gulf teemed with fish, even close in. If Eastlake wanted to shoot something, he could usually do it at point-blank range. I don't understand these tips, I said. Wireman said, Nor do I. She has at least a dozen harpoons, including four mounted on the wall in the library, and none of them are like these. Jack had gone into the bathroom and come back with a bottle of hydrogen peroxide. Now he took the harpoon I was holding and examined the triple-bladed tip. What is it, silver? Wireman made his thumb and forefinger into a gun and pointed it at him. Hold your cards, but Wireman thinks you have scored a bingo. And you don't get that? Jack asked. Wireman and I looked at each other, then at Jack again. You haven't been watching the right movies, he said. Silver bullets are what you use to kill werewolves. I don't know if silver works on vampires or not, but obviously somebody thought it did, or that it might. If you're suggesting Tessie and Laura Eastlake are vampires, Wireman said, they must have built up a hell of a thirst since 1927. He looked at me, expecting corroboration. I think Jack's onto something, I said. I took the bottle of peroxide, dipped the finger I'd pricked into it, and splashed the bottle up and down a couple times. Man law, Jack said, grimacing. Not unless you were planning to drink it, I said. And after a moment's consideration, Jack and I both burst out laughing. Huh? Wireman asked. I don't get it. Never mind, Jack said, still grinning. Then he grew serious again. But there are no such things as vampires, Edgar. There could be ghosts, I'll give you that much. I think almost everyone believes there could be ghosts, but there's no such thing as vampires. He brightened as an idea struck him. Besides, it takes a vampire to make a vampire. The Eastlake twins drowned. I picked up the short harpoon again, turning it from side to side, making the reflection from the tarnished tip tumble along the wall. Still, this is suggestive. Really, Jack agreed. So's the unlocked door you found when you brought the picnic basket, I said. The tracks, the canvas that was lifted out of the rack and put onto the easel. You're saying it was the crazy librarian after all, amigo? No, just that... My voice cracked, broke. I had to take another sip of water before I could say what needed saying. Just maybe that vampires aren't the only things that come back from the dead. What are you talking about? Jack asked. Zombies? I thought of the Percy with her rotting sails. Let's say, deserters. 11. Are you sure you want to be here alone tonight, Edgar? Wireman asked. Because I'm not sure it's such a great idea, especially with that stack of old pictures for company. He sighed. You have succeeded in giving Wireman a first-class case of the willies. We were sitting out in the Florida room, watching the sun start its long, slow decline toward the horizon. I had produced cheese and crackers. I'm not sure this will work otherwise, I said. Think of me as a gunslinger of the art world. I paint alone, partner. Jack looked at me over a fresh glass of iced tea. You're planning to paint? Well, sketch. It's what I know how to do. And when I thought back to a certain pair of gardening gloves, hands printed on the back of one, off on the back of the other, I thought sketching would be enough, especially if I did it with little Elizabeth Eastlake's colored pencils. I swung around to Wireman. You have the funeral parlor tonight, correct? Wireman glanced at his watch and heaved a sigh. Correct, from 6 until 8. There's another visitation tomorrow from noon until 2. Relatives from afar will come to bare their teeth at the usurping interloper. That would be me. Then the final act day after tomorrow. Funeral at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Osprey. That's at 10. Followed by cremation at Abbott Wexler. Bernie, Bernie, hot, hot, hot. Jack grimaced. Gross me out. Wireman nodded. Death is gross, son. Remember what we sang as children? The worms crawl in, the worms crawl out, and the pus runs out like shaving cream. Classy, I said. Yep, Wireman agreed. He selected another cracker, looked at it, then threw it violently back onto the tray. It bounced onto the floor. This is nuts! The whole thing! Jack picked up the cracker, seemed to consider eating it, then put it aside. Perhaps he had decided eating crackers off a Florida room floor violated another man law. Probably it did. There are so many. I said to Wireman, when you come back from the funeral parlor tonight, you check in on me, okay? Yes. If I tell you I'm fine, to just go on home, you do it. Don't interrupt you if you're communing with your muse or the spirits. I nodded, because he wasn't that far off. Then I turned to Jack. And you're staying at El Palacio while Wireman's at the funeral parlor, right? Sure, if that's what you guys want. He looked a little uneasy about it, and I didn't blame him. It was a big house. Elizabeth had lived in it a long time, and it was where her memory was freshest. I would have been uneasy, too, if I hadn't been sure the spooks on Duma Key were elsewhere. If I call you, come on the run. I will. Call me on the house phone or my cell phone. You sure your cell phone's working? He looked slightly shamefaced. Battery was a little flat is all. I got it charged in my car. Wireman said, I wish I understood better why you feel like you have to keep fooling with this, Edgar. Because it's not over. For years it was. For years Elizabeth lived here very quietly, first with her father and then on her own. She had her charities. She had her friends, she played tennis, she played bridge, so Mary Iyer told me. And most of all, she had the Suncoast art scene. It was the quiet, rewarding life of an elderly woman with lots of money and few bad habits other than her cigarettes. Then things started to change. La Loteria. You said it yourself, Wireman. You really think something's been making all this happen? He said. Not with disbelief, with awe. It's what you believe, I said. Sometimes I do. It isn't what I want to believe, that there's something with a reach so long, with eyesight keen enough to see you, me, God knows who or what else. I don't like it either, I said. But that was far from the truth. Truth was, I hated it. I don't like the idea that something may have actually reached out and killed Elizabeth. Maybe scared her to death, just to shut her up. And you think you can find out what's going on from those pictures? Some, yes. How much, I won't know until I try. And then? It depends. Almost certainly a trip to the south end of the Key. There's unfinished business there. Jack put down his tea glass. What unfinished business? I shook my head. Don't know. Her pictures may tell me.
Just as long as you don't get in over your head and discover you can't get back to shore, Wireman said. That's what happened to those two little girls.
I know it, I said. Jack pointed his finger at me. Take care of yourself. Man law. I nodded and pointed back. Man law. XV. Intruder. 1. 20 minutes later, I sat in Little Pink with my sketch pad on my lap and the red picnic basket beside me. Directly ahead, filling the western-facing window with light, was the Gulf. Far below me was the murmur of the shells. I had set my easel aside and covered my paint-splattered work table with a piece of toweling. I laid the remains of her freshly sharpened colored pencils on top of it. There wasn't much left of those pencils, which were fat and somehow antique. But I thought there'd be enough. I was ready. Bullshit I am, I said. I was never going to be ready for this. And part of me was hoping nothing would happen. I thought something would, though. I thought that was why Elizabeth had wanted me to find her drawings. But how much of what was inside the red basket did she actually remember? My guess was that Elizabeth had forgotten most of what had happened to her when she was a child, even before the Alzheimer's came along to complicate things. Because forgetting isn't always involuntary. Sometimes it's willed. Who would want to remember something so awful that it had made your father scream until he bled? Better to stop drawing completely, to just go cold turkey. Better to tell people you can hardly even draw stick figures. That when it comes to art, you're like wealthy alums who support their college sports teams. If you can't be an athlete, be an athletic supporter. Better to put it out of your mind completely, and in your old age, creeping senility will take care of the rest. Oh, some of that old ability may still remain, like scar tissue on the dura of the brain from an old injury, caused by falling out of a pony trap, let's say. And you might have to find ways to let that out once in a while, to express it like a buildup of pus from an infection that will never quite heal. So you get interested in other people's art. You become, in fact, a patron of the arts. And if that's still not enough, why, maybe you begin to collect China figures and buildings. You begin to build yourself a Chinatown. No one will call creating such tableau art, but it's certainly imaginative, and the regular exercise of the imagination, its visual aspect in particular, is enough to make it stop. Make what stop? The itch, of course. That damnable itch. I scratched at my right arm, passed through it, and for the 10,000th time found only my ribs. I flipped back the cover of my pad to the first sheet. Start with a blank surface. It called to me, as I was sure such blank sheets had once called to her. Fill me up. Because white is the absence of memory, the color of can't remember. Make, show, draw. And when you do, the itch will go away. For a while, the confusion will subside. Please stay on the Key, she had said. No matter what happens, we need you. I thought that might be true. I sketched quickly, just a few strokes, something that could have been a cart, or possibly a pony trap, standing still and waiting for the pony. They lived here happily enough, I told the empty studio. Father and daughters. Then Elizabeth fell out of the pony trap and started to draw. The off-season hurricane exposed the debris field. The little girls drowned. Then the rest of them pop off to Miami and the trouble stops. And when they came back nearly 25 years later. Beneath the pony trap I printed, fine, paused, added, again, fine again. Fine, the shells whispered far below. Fine again. Yes, they had been fine, John and Elizabeth had been fine. And after John died, Elizabeth had continued being fine. Fine with her art shows, fine with her chinas. Then things had for some reason begun to change again. I didn't know if the deaths of Wireman's wife and daughter had been part of that change, but I thought they might have been. And about his arrival and mine on Duma Key, I thought there was no question. I had no rational reason for believing that, but I did. Things on Duma Key had been okay, then strange. Then for a long time, they had been okay again, and now, she's awake. The table is leaking. If I wanted to know what was happening now, I had to know what happened then. Dangerous or not, I had to. 2. I picked up her first drawing, the single line running across the paper. I took it in my left hand, closed my eyes, and then pretended I was touching it with my right, just as I had with Pam's hands-off gardening gloves. I tried to see my right fingers running over that hesitant line. I could, sort of, but I felt a kind of despair. Did I mean to do this with all of the pictures? There had to be 12 dozen, and that was a conservative estimate. Also, I wasn't exactly being overwhelmed with psychic information. Take it easy. Rome wasn't built in an hour. I decided a little radio-free bone couldn't hurt and might help. I got up, holding the ancient piece of paper in my right hand, and of course it went fluttering to the floor because there was no right hand. I bent to pick it up, thinking I had the saying wrong. The saying was Rome wasn't built in a day, but Melda says an hour. I stopped, holding the sheet of paper in my left hand, the hand the crane hadn't been able to get to. Was that an actual memory, something that had come drifting out of the picture, or just something I'd made up? Just my mind trying to be obliging? It's not a picture, I said, looking at the hesitant line. No, but it tried to be a picture. My ass went back onto the seat of my chair with a thump. It wasn't a voluntary act of sitting, it was more a case of my knees losing their lock and letting go. I looked at the line, then out the window. From the gulf to the line, from the line to the gulf. She had tried to draw the horizon. It had been her first thing. Yes. I picked up my pad and seized one of her pencils. It didn't matter which one as long as it was hers. It felt too big, too fat in my hand. It also felt just right. I began to draw. On Duma Key, it was what I did best. 3. I sketched a child sitting on a potty chair. Her head was bandaged. She had a drinking glass in one hand. Her other arm was slung around her father's neck. He was wearing a strap-style undershirt and had shaving cream on his cheeks. Standing in the background, just a shadow, was the housekeeper. No bracelets in this sketch because she didn't always wear them, but the kerchief was wrapped around her head, the knot in front. Nan Melda, the closest thing to a mother Libet ever knew. Libet. Yes, that was what they called her. What she called herself. Libet. Little Libet. The littlest one of all, I murmured, and flicked back the first page of the sketch pad. The pencil, too short, too fat, unused for over 3/4 of a century, was the perfect tool. The perfect channel. It began to move again. I sketched the little girl in a room. Books appeared on the wall behind her, and it was a study. Daddy's study. The bandage was wound around her head. She was at a desk. She was wearing what looked like a house coat. She had a pencil in her hand. One of the colored pencils? Probably not, not then, not yet, but it didn't matter. She had found her thing, her focus, her métier. And how hungry it made her, how ravenous. She thinks, I will have more paper, please. She thinks, I am Elizabeth. She literally drew herself back into the world, I said, and my body broke out in goose flesh from head to toe, for hadn't I done the same? Hadn't I done exactly the same here on Duma Key? I had more work to do. I thought it was going to be a long and exhausting evening, but I felt I was on the verge of great discoveries, and what I felt wasn't fright, not then, but a kind of copper-mouthed excitement. I bent down and picked up Elizabeth's third drawing, the fourth, the fifth, the sixth, moving with greater and greater speed. Sometimes I stopped to draw, but mostly I didn't have to. The pictures were forming in my head now, and the reason I didn't have to put them down on paper seemed clear to me. Elizabeth had already done that work, long ago, when she had been recovering from the accident that nearly killed her. In the happy days before Noveen began to talk. 4. At one point during my interview with Mary Iyer, she said discovering in my middle age that I could paint with the best of them must have been like having someone give me the keys to a souped-up muscle car, a Roadrunner, or a GTO. I said, yes, it was like that. At another point, she said it must have been like having someone give me the keys to a fully furnished house, a mansion, really. I said, yes, like that, too. And if she had gone on, said it must have been like inheriting a million shares of Microsoft stock, or being elected ruler for life of some oil-rich and peaceful emirate in the Mideast, I would have said, yeah, sure, you bet, to soothe her, because those questions were about her. I could see the longing look in her eyes when she asked them. They were the eyes of a kid who knows the closest she's ever going to get to realizing her dream of the high trapeze is sitting on the bleachers at the Saturday matinee performance. She was a critic. And lots of critics who aren't called to do what they write about grow jealous and mean and small in their disappointment. Mary wasn't like that. Mary still loved it all. She drank whiskey from a water glass and wanted to know what it was like when Tinkerbell flew out of nowhere and tapped you on the shoulder and you discovered that, even though you were on the wrinkle-neck side of 50, you had suddenly gained the ability to fly past the face of the moon. So even though it wasn't like having a fast car, or being handed the keys to a fully furnished house, I told her it was. Because you can't tell anyone what it's like. You can only talk around it until everyone's exhausted and it's time to go to sleep. But Elizabeth had known what it was like. It was in her drawings, then in her paintings. It was like being given a tongue when you had been mute. And more, better. It was like being given back your memory. And a person's memory is everything, really. Memory is identity. It's you. Even from that first line, that incredibly brave first line meant to show where the gulf met the sky. She had understood that seeing and memory were interchangeable and had set out to mend herself. Percy hadn't been in it, not at first. I was sure of that. 5. For the next 4 hours, I slipped in and out of Libet's world. It was a wonderful, frightening place to be. Sometimes I scribbled words. The gift is always hungry. Start with what you know. But mostly it was pictures. Pictures were the real language we shared. I understood her family's quick arc from amazement to acceptance to boredom. It had happened partly because the girl was so prolific, maybe more because she was part of them. She was their little Libet. And there's always that feeling that no good can come out of Nazareth, isn't there? But their boredom only made her hunger stronger. She looked for new ways to wow them, sought new ways of seeing, and found them, God help her. I drew birds flying upside down and animals walking on the swimming pool. I drew a horse with a smile so big it ran off the sides of its face. I thought it was right around then that Percy had entered the picture, only Libet didn't know it was Percy, I said. She thought. I thumbed back through her drawings almost to the beginning, to the round black face with the smiling mouth. At first glance, I had dismissed this one as Elizabeth's portrait of Nan Melda, but I should have known better. It was a child's face, not a woman's. A doll's face. Suddenly my hand was printing Noveen beside it in strokes so hard that Elizabeth's old canary yellow pencil snapped on the last stroke of the second N. I threw it on the floor and grabbed another. It was Noveen that Percy had spoken through first, so as not to frighten her little genius. What could be less threatening than a little black girl dolly who smiled and wore a red kerchief around her head, just like the beloved Nan Melda? And was Elizabeth shocked or frightened when the doll began to speak on its own? I didn't think so. She might have been fiercely talented in that one narrow way, but she was still only a child of three. Noveen told her things to draw, and Elizabeth. I grabbed my sketch pad again, drew a cake lying on the floor, splattered on the floor, Little Libet thought that prank was Noveen's idea, but it had been Percy testing Elizabeth's power. Percy experimenting, as I had experimented, trying to find out how powerful this new tool might be. Next had come the Alice. Because her doll whispered, there was a treasure and a storm would uncover it. So not an Alice at all, not really. And not an Elizabeth, because she hadn't been Elizabeth yet. Not to her family, not to herself. The big blow of 27 had been Hurricane Libet. Because Daddy would like finding a treasure. And because Daddy needed to think of something besides, she's made her bed, I said in a harsh voice that didn't sound like my own. Let her sleep in it. Besides how mad he was at Addie for running off with Emery, that celluloid collar. Yes, that's how it had been on the south end of Duma Key back in 27. I drew John Eastlake, only it was just his fins showing against the sky and the tip of his snorkel and a shadow beneath. John Eastlake diving for treasure. Diving for his youngest daughter's new doll, although he probably didn't believe it. Beside one flipper, I printed the words, Fair Salvage. The images rose in my mind, clearer and clearer, as if they had been waiting all these years to be liberated, and I wondered briefly if every painting, and every implement used to make them, from those on the walls of the caves in Central Asia to the Mona Lisa, held such hidden memories of their making and makers, encoded in their strokes like DNA. Swim and kick till I say stop. I added Elizabeth to the picture of diving Daddy, standing up to her chubby knees in the water, Noveen tucked under her arm. Libet almost could have been the doll girl in the sketch Ilsa had demanded, the one I titled The End of the Game. And after he saw all those things, he hugged me, hugged me, hugged me. I made a hurried little sketch of John Eastlake doing just that, his face mask pushed up on top of his head. The picnic basket was nearby on a blanket, and the spear gun was resting on top of it. He hugged me, hugged me, hugged me. Draw her, a voice whispered. Draw Elizabeth's Fair Salvage. Draw Percy. But I wouldn't. I was afraid of what I might see, and what it might do to me. And what about Daddy? What about John? How much had he known? I flipped through her drawings to the picture of John Eastlake screaming, with blood running from his nose and one eye. He had known plenty, probably too late, but he had known. What exactly had happened to Tessie and Lolo, and to Percy, to shut her up for all those years? What exactly was she? Not a doll. That much seemed sure. I could have gone on. A picture of Tessie and Lolo running down a path, some path, hand in hand, was already asking to be drawn. But I was beginning to come out of my half-trance and was scared almost to death. Besides, I thought I knew enough to be going on with. Wireman could help me figure out the rest. I was almost sure of it. I closed my sketch pad. I put down that long-gone little girl's brown pencil, now just a nubbin, and realized I was hungry, ravenous, in fact. But that kind of hangover wasn't new to me, and there was plenty to eat in the refrigerator. 6. I went downstairs slowly, my head spinning with images, an upside-down heron with blue gimlet eyes, the smiling horses, the boat-sized swim fins on Daddy's feet, and I didn't bother with the living room lights. There was no need to. By April, I could have navigated the route from the foot of the stairs to the kitchen in pitch blackness. By then, I had made that solitary house with its chin jutting over the edge of the water my own. And in spite of everything, I couldn't imagine leaving it. Halfway across the room, I stopped, looking out through the Florida room to the Gulf. There, riding at anchor no more than 100 yards from the beach, clear and unmistakable in the light of a quarter moon and a million stars, was the Percy. Her sails had been furled, but nets of rope sagged from her ancient masts like spiderwebs. The shrouds, I thought. Those are its shrouds. She bobbed up and down like a long-dead child's rotten toy. The decks were empty, so far as I could see, of both life and souvenirs. But who knew what might be below decks? I was going to faint. At the same instant I realized this, I realized why. I had stopped breathing. I told myself to inhale, but for one terrible second nothing happened. My chest remained as flat as a page in a closed book. When it rose at last, I heard a whooping sound. That was me struggling to go on with life in a conscious state. I blew out the air I had just taken in and inhaled more, a little less noisily. Black specks flocked in front of my eyes in the dimness, then faded. I expected the ship out there to do the same. Surely it had been a hallucination, but it remained. Perhaps 120 feet long and a little less than half that in the beam. Bobbing on the waves. Rocking from side to side just a little too. Bowsprit wagging like a finger, seeming to say, "Oh, you nasty man, you're in for it." I slapped myself across the face hard enough to bring water to my left eye, and the ship was still right there. I realized that if it was there, truly there, then Jack would be able to see it from the boardwalk at El Palacio. There was a phone on the far side of the living room, but from where I was standing, the one on the kitchen counter was closer, and it had the advantage of being right under the light switches. I wanted lights, especially the ones in the kitchen, those good hard fluorescents. I backed out of the living room, not taking my eyes off the ship, and hit all three switches with the back of my hand. The lights came on, and I lost sight of the Percy, of everything beyond the Florida room, in their bright, no-nonsense glare. I reached for the phone, then stopped. There was a man in my kitchen. He was standing by my refrigerator. He was wearing soaked rags that might once have been blue jeans, and the kind of shirt that's called a boat neck. What appeared to be moss was growing on his throat, cheeks, forehead, and forearms. The right side of his skull was crushed in. Petals of bone protruded through the lank foliage of his dark hair. One of his eyes, the right one, was gone. What remained was a spongy socket. The other was an alien, disheartening silver that had nothing to do with humanity. His feet were bare, swollen, purple, and burst through to the bone at the ankles. It grinned at me, lips splitting as they drew back, revealing two lines of yellow teeth set into old black gums. It raised its right arm, and here I saw what must have been another relic of the Percy. It was a manacle. One old and rusty circlet was clamped around the thing's wrist. The other one hung open like a loose jaw. The other one was for me. It emitted a loose hissing sound, perhaps all its decayed vocal cords could produce, and began to walk toward me under the bright no-nonsense fluorescence. It left footprints on the hardwood floor. It cast a shadow. I could hear a faint creaking and saw it was wearing a soaked leather belt, rotten, but for the time being still holding. A queer, soft paralysis had come over me. I was conscious, but I couldn't run, even though I understood what that open manacle meant, and what this thing was, a one-man press gang. He would clamp me and take me aboard yonder frigate or schooner or barkentine or whatever the hell it was. I would become part of the crew. And while there might not be cabin boys on the Percy, I thought there were at least two cabin girls, one named Tessie and one named Lolo. You have to run. At least clock at one with the phone, for Christ's sake. But I couldn't. I was like a bird hypnotized by a snake. The best I could do was to take one numb step backward into the living room, then another. Then a third. Now I was in the shadows again. It stood in the kitchen doorway with the white light of the fluorescence striking across its damp and rotted face, and throwing its shadow across the living room carpet, still grinning. I considered closing my eyes and trying to wish it away, but that wasn't going to work. I could smell it, like a dumpster behind a restaurant that specializes in fish dinners, and time to go, Edgar. It could talk, after all. The words were slushy but understandable. It took a step into the living room. I took another of my numb steps backward, knowing in my heart it would do no good, that compensation wasn't enough, that when it got tired of playing it would simply dart forward and clamp that iron manacle on my wrist and drag me screaming down to the water, down to the Caldo Largo, and the last sound I'd hear on the living side would be the grating conversation of the shells under the house. Then the water would fill my ears. I took another step back just the same, not sure I was even moving toward the door, only hoping. Then another, and a hand fell on my shoulder. I shrieked. 7. "What the fuck is that thing?" Wireman whispered in my ear. "I don't know," I said, and I was sobbing, sobbing with fear. "Yes, I do know. Look out at the gulf, Wireman." "I can't, I don't dare take my eyes off it." But the thing in the doorway had seen Wireman now. Wireman who'd come in through the open door just as it had itself. Wireman who had arrived like the cavalry in a John Wayne Western, and had stopped 3 steps inside the living room, its head slightly lowered, the manacle swinging back and forth from its outstretched arm. "Christ," Wireman said, "that ship. The one in the paintings."
"Go on," the thing said. "We have no business with you. Go on and you may live."
"It's lying," I said.
"Tell me something I don't know," Wireman said, then raised his voice. He was standing just behind me, and he almost blew out my eardrum.
"Leave! You're trespassing!"
The drowned young man made no reply, but it was every bit as fast as I had feared. At one moment it was standing 3 steps inside the living room, at the next it was right in front of me, and I had only the vaguest flickering impression of it crossing the distance between. Its smell, rot and seaweed and dead fish turning to soup in the sun, bloomed and became overwhelming. I felt its hands, freezing cold, close over my forearm and cried out in shock and horror. It wasn't the cold. It was how soft they were, how flabby. That one silver eye peered at me, seeming to drill into my brain, and for a moment there was a sensation of being filled with pure darkness. Then the manacle clamped on my wrist with a flat, hard clacking sound.
"Wireman!"
I screamed, but Wireman was gone. He was running away from me across the room as fast as he could. The drowned thing and I were chained together. It dragged me toward the door. 8. Wireman was back just before the dead man could pull me over the threshold. He had something in his hand that looked like a blunt dagger. For a moment I thought it must be one of the silver harpoons, but that was only a powerful bit of wishful thinking. The silver harpoons were upstairs with the red picnic basket.
"Hey," he said. "Hey, you. Yeah, I'm talking to you. Cojuta de puto madre."
Its head snapped around as fast as the head of a snake about to strike. Wireman was almost as fast. Holding the blunt object in both hands, he drove it into the thing's face, striking home just above the right eye socket. The thing shrieked, a sound that went through my head like shards of glass. I saw Wireman wince and stagger back, saw him struggle to hold on to his weapon and drop it to the sandy floor of the entryway. It didn't matter. The man-thing which had seemed so solid spun into insubstantiality, clothes and all. I felt the manacle around my wrist also lose its solidity. For a moment I could still see it, and then it was only water dripping onto my sneakers and the carpet. There was a larger wet patch where the demon sailor had been only a moment before. I felt thicker warmth on my face and wiped blood from my nose and off my upper lip. Wireman had fallen over a hassock. I helped him up and saw his nose was bleeding too. A line of blood also ran down the side of his throat from his left ear. It rose and fell with the rapid beat of his heart.
"Christ, that scream," he said. "My eyes are watering, my ears are ringing like a motherfucker. Can you hear me, Edgar?"
"Yes," I said.
"Are you all right?"
"Other than thinking I just saw a dead guy disappear in fucking front of me, I guess so." He bent down, picked up the blunt cylinder off the floor, and kissed it.
"Glory be to God for dappled things," he said, then barked laughter. "Even when they're not dappled."
It was a candlestick. The tip, where you were supposed to stick your candle, looked dark as if it had touched something very hot instead of something cold and wet.
"There are candles in all Miss Eastlake's rentals because we lose the power out here all the time," Wireman said. "We have a Jenny at the big house, but the other places don't, not even this one. But unlike the smaller houses, this one does have candlesticks from the big house, and they just happen to be silver."
"And you remembered that," I said. Marveled, really. He shrugged, then looked at the gulf.
So did I. There was nothing there but moonlight and starlight on the water. For now, at least. Wireman gripped my wrist. His fingers closed over it where the manacle had been, and my heart jumped.
What?
I said, not liking the new fear I saw in his face. Jack, he said. Jack's alone at El Palacio. We took Wireman's car. In my terror, I'd never noticed the headlights or heard it pull in beside my own. 9. Jack was okay. There had been a few calls from old friends of Elizabeth's, but the last one had come at 9:15, an hour and a half before we came bursting in, bloody and wide-eyed, Wireman still waving the candlestick. There had been no intruders at El Palacio, and Jack hadn't seen the ship that had been anchored for a while in the gulf off Big Pink. Jack had been eating microwave popcorn and watching Beverly Hills Cop on an old videotape. He listened to our story with mounting amazement, but no real disbelief. This was a young man, I had to remind myself, that had been raised on shows like The X-Files and Lost. Besides, it fit with what he'd been told earlier. When we were done, he took the candlestick from Wireman and examined the tip, which looked like the burned filament in a dead light bulb.
"Why didn't it come from me?" he asked. "I was alone and totally unprepared."
I don't want to bruise your self-esteem, I said, but I don't think you're exactly a priority to whoever's running this show. Jack was looking at the narrow red mark on my wrist. Edgar, is that where... I nodded.
Fuck, Jack said in a low voice.
Have you figured out what's going on? Wireman asked me. If she sent that thing after you, she must think you have, or that you're close.
I don't think anyone will ever know all of it, I said. But I know who that thing was when it was alive.
Who? Jack was staring at me with wide eyes. We were standing in the kitchen and Jack was still holding the candlestick. Now he put it aside on the counter. Emery Paulson. Adriana Eastlake's husband. They came back from Atlanta to help with the search after Tessie and Laura went missing. That much is true. But they never left Duma Key again. Percy saw to that. 10. We went into the parlor where I had first met Elizabeth Eastlake. The long, low table was still there, but now it was empty. Its polished surface struck me as a pitch-perfect mockery of life. "Where are they?" I asked Wireman. "Where are her chinas? Where's the village?" "I boxed everything up and put it in the summer kitchen," he said, pointing vaguely. "No real reason, I just couldn't..." "Muchacho, would you like some green tea or a beer?" I asked for water. Jack said he'd take a beer if that was all right. Wireman set off to get them. He made it as far as the hallway before starting to cry. There were big, noisy sobs, the kind you can't stifle no matter how hard you try. Jack and I looked at each other, then looked away. We said nothing. 11. He was gone a lot longer than it usually takes to get 2 cans of beer and a glass of water, but when he came back, he had regained his composure. "Sorry," he said. "I don't usually lose someone I love and poke a candlestick in a vampire's face in the same week. Usually it's one or the other." He shrugged his shoulders in an effort at insouciance. It was unsuccessful, but I had to give him points for trying. "They're not vampires," I said.
"Then what are they?" he asked.
"Expatiate?"
"I can only tell you what her pictures told me. You have to remember that no matter how talented she might have been, she was still only a child." I hesitated, then shook my head.
"Not even that. Hardly more than a baby. Percy was..."
"I guess you'd say Percy was her spirit guide."
Wireman cracked his beer, sipped it, then leaned forward.
"And what about you? Is Percy your spirit guide as well? Has she been intensifying what you do?"
"Of course she has," I said. "She's been testing the limits of my ability and extending them. I'm sure that's what Candy Brown was about. And she's been picking my material. That's what the girl and ship paintings were about."
"And the rest of your stuff?" Jack asked.
"Mostly mine, I think, but some of it."
I stopped, suddenly struck by a terrible idea. I put my glass aside and almost knocked it over.
Oh, Christ. What? Wireman asked. For God's sake, what? You need to get your little red book of phone numbers, right now. He went and got it, then handed me the cordless telephone. I sat for a moment with it in my lap, not sure who to call first. Then I knew. But there is one rule of modern life even more ironclad than the one which states that there's never a cop around when you need one. When you really need a human being, you always get the answering machine. That's what I got at Dario Nannuzzi's home, at Jimmy Yoshida's, at Alice O'Coin's. Fuck! I cried, slamming the disconnect button with my thumb when Alice's recorded voice started in with, I'm sorry I'm not here to take your call right now, but... They're probably still celebrating, Wireman said. Give it time, amigo, and it'll all quiet down. I don't have time, I said. Fuck, shit, fuck! He put a hand on mine and spoke soothingly. What is it, Edgar? What's wrong? The pictures are dangerous. Maybe not all, but some for sure. He thought about it, then nodded. Okay, let's think about this. The most dangerous ones are probably the Girl in Ship series, right? Yes, I'm sure that's the case. They're almost certainly still at the gallery, waiting to be framed and shipped. Shipped. Dear God, shipped. Even the word was scary. I can't let that happen. Muchacho, getting sidetracked is what you can't let happen. He didn't understand this wasn't a sidetrack. Percy could whistle up a great win when she wanted to. But she needed help. I found the number of the Scotto and dialed it. I thought it was just possible that someone might be there, even at 10:45 on the night after the big shindig. But the ironclad rule held, and I got the machine. I waited impatiently, then pressed 9 to leave a general message. Listen, you guys, I said. This is Edgar. I don't want you to send any of the paintings or drawings out until I tell you, okay? Not a single one. Just put a hold on them for a few days. Use any excuse you have to, but do it. Please, it's very important. I broke the connection and looked at Wireman. Will they? Considering your demonstrated earning power, you bet. And you just spared yourself a long, involved conversation. Now, can we get back to... Not yet. My family and friends would be the most vulnerable, and the fact that they'd gone their separate ways afforded me no comfort. Percy had already demonstrated that her reach was long, and I had started meddling. I thought she was angry with me, or frightened of me, or both. My first impulse was to call Pam, but then I remembered what Wireman had said about sparing myself a long, involved conversation. I consulted my own untrustworthy memory instead of Wireman's little book, and for once, under pressure, it came through. But I'll get his answering machine, I thought. And I did. But at first I didn't know it. Hello, Edgar. Tom Riley's voice, but not Tom's voice. It was dead of emotion. It's the drugs he takes, I thought. Although that deadness hadn't been there at the Scotto. Tom, listen and don't say anything. But the voice went on. That dead voice. She'll kill you, you know. You and all your friends. The way she's killed me. Only I'm still alive. I staggered on my feet. Edgar, Wireman said sharply. Edgar, what's wrong? Shut up, I said. I need to hear. The message seemed to be over, but I could still hear him breathing. Slow, shallow respiration coming from Minnesota. Then he resumed. Being dead is better, he said. Now I have to go and kill Pam. Tom, I shouted at the message. Tom, wake up! After we're dead, we're going to be married. It's to be a shipboard wedding. She promised. Tom! Wireman and Jack crowding in, one gripping my arm, the other gripping my stump, I hardly noticed. And then, leave a message at the beep. The beep came, and then the line went silent. I didn't hang up the phone. I dropped it. I turned to Wireman. Tom Riley's gone to kill my wife, I said. And then went on, although the words didn't feel like mine. He may have done it already. 12. Wireman didn't ask for an explanation, just told me to call her. I put the telephone back to my ear, but I couldn't remember the number. Wireman read it to me, but I couldn't punch it in. The bad side of my vision had, for the first time in weeks, come over all red. Jack did it for me. I stood listening to the phone ring in Mendota Heights, waiting for Pam's bright, impersonal voice on the answering machine.